I'm joined this afternoon on the phone by John Lindsay Poland. He coordinates the Latin America program for the Fellowship of Reconciliation. The Fellowship of Reconciliation is a national interfaith peace and justice organization. And John has been to the area 5 times. Hello, John.
Hi, good afternoon.
Thanks for joining me today. So you're joining me this afternoon to talk about the human rights situation in Colombia as well as the U.S. government's foreign policy towards Colombia. Can we just begin by, if you could describe the work that the Fellowship of Reconciliation does in Colombia and why you do that work?
Yeah, the Fellowship of Reconciliation was founded in 1914 on the eve of the First World War and has always been basically about opposing wars of any kind and not seeing other people as our enemies, but trying to cross the boundaries that war creates and also challenging the injustices that so often lead to war. And our work in Colombia came out of our work on Latin America, but also we give a Peace Prize every year. And in 1998, there was a community in Colombia that was nominated for this Peace Prize and won it. It's a community near the Panamanian border that has, it's in a combat area where all the armed groups are active, and they have refused to support any of the armed groups. They don't carry weapons. They don't give information to the armed groups. They don't sell things to them. So we gave an award to this community, and they came to the U.S. to receive it, and then they invited us there, and we began a relationship which has developed into one of permanent accompaniment in which we have an ongoing team in Colombia. You know, I became involved in the 1980s when the United States was so involved in the wars in Central America, and traveled to Central America and accompanied people in Guatemala and El Salvador who were threatened by death squads as a way of supporting their ability to continue to work nonviolently for change. And I just was so moved and, you know, it just kind of opened so many doors to me that when I came back to the United States, I really wanted to do something about the role of this country in Central America. And that was about 20 years ago, and I've been doing various kinds of research and organizing and writing since then about wherever the United States is involved in Latin America.
Let's talk about the community that you mentioned. Can you, again, tell what is the name of the community?
The name is San Jose de Apartado. It's in northwestern Colombia, so it's near the Panamanian border, and that part of Colombia is close to both the Caribbean coast as well as the Pacific coast. And it's in the foothills of one of the 3 main mountain ranges that run north to south in Colombia. You know, Colombia is huge. It's about the size of France, Spain, Portugal, and Holland put together. And in this community, it's a mestizo peasant community, and most of the people who live there farm for a living, and most of them were also displaced by earlier violence in Colombia from another town and moved there in the 1970s. It's an area where there's lots of bananas grown. It's kind of the heart of the banana growing section of Colombia. And so people there do grow a very small banana that's exported. They also grow cocoa, not coca leaf, that is made into cocaine, which is not so much planted in that part of the country, but cocoa that's made into chocolate. And then they also do subsistence farming of primarily of rice, as well as some vegetables. And so they have been a very prominent community because they were one of the first communities, there have been a number of them, that have said they don't want to be part of the armed conflict. They don't want to have any part of it. They don't want to support any of the groups, partly because they don't support them and partly because if they do, then they become a target of the enemy group.
Have they become a target anyway, even though they've decided not to let any of the armed groups operate within their community? Have they suffered from that? Have they been a target anyway?
Yeah, they have. The army says that they're supported and infiltrated by the guerrillas, the leftist guerrillas. They have also been subject to some guerrilla attacks, some guerrilla killings primarily. More than 130 people in the community have been killed. This is out of a population of about 1,300, so about 1 in 10 people. They've still stayed on their land. Most people, when that kind of violence hits them, they move, and they move to the cities where there are vast numbers of shanty towns and unemployed people. People try and get away from the conflict, but the conflict exists in the cities too because the armed groups have militias in the cities, and so often the conflict still follows them into the cities. So this community, as well as a number of others, have said, no, we're going to stay on the land, we're going to keep farming and producing, even if it means that we face violence. It's probably been less because they have been such a prominent case and because they've had international accompaniment for the last 6 or 7 years. And so when there are international volunteers who are present, like from the fellowship or from other visitors or from another group called Peace Brigades International, typically there's no violence committed. But it's a large enough area that you can't protect everybody all the time.
Can we talk about the overall human rights situation in Colombia? My understanding is that Colombia is one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a journalist, to be a labor union organizer, a teacher, in particular, labor union organizers have been killed in large
targeted numbers.
So can you speak to the overall human rights picture there?
Well, I think what you're saying about trade unions is really a reflection of the conflict, which is over resources. Colombia is a very rich country. It produces a lot, and not just in cocaine, but in legal products, oil, coffee, other kinds of agricultural products, energy. And so trade unionists who are trying to get a better share for workers of that wealth become targets of the people who are controlling the wealth. So, the violence in Colombia has been going on for more than 40 years, and it continues to be a pattern of people who organize and then are killed by squads or paramilitaries who are organized by landowners, often landowners together with the military or together with drug traffickers who are threatened by the organizing. It is still primarily a rural conflict, so many of those killed are in rural areas, but it's also true that in the cities where, for example, the oil workers union has had a very large number of people, of trade unionists killed. I think the figures are about 2,000 trade unionists in Colombia who've been killed. It's something that you struggle to win the space back for, and people still organize because they want to see something better. They want something better for their families and their kids. But it's very painful to see that many people killed off.
Who is responsible for the majority of the human rights violations? You mentioned landowners sometimes working with the military, the Colombian military, and drug traffickers. Who's responsible? How does it break down, percentage-wise?
Well, there's two large guerrilla armies. There's the army, And then there's a paramilitary army that is allied with the army, but is not the same institution. And until the mid-80s, most of the killings were carried out by the army. And they got a lot of criticism in the international community for it, and the Colombian government was dependent enough on the international community that they kind of outsourced it in a way. So the paramilitaries now do a lot of the dirty work, about 70% or so of the killings and massacres and displacements of people. When I say displacement, I mean actions that caused the thousands of people to flee their lands are carried out by the paramilitaries. And they work together with the army. The army shares information with them, or the army will, for example, they'll cordon off an area, and it will be hard to get in or out except for the paramilitaries, who will come in, do their dirty work, and leave. And then the military, having let them get out, will then move in and begin to investigate, or take out on an official presence. The guerrillas also carry out killings and displacements, and in some cases massacres. They've been fighting for more than 40 years, and I would say for the FARC, which is the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, it's the largest guerrilla group, it's become kind of a business. But all that said, most people in Colombia don't want to be part of it, and that what I'm describing really just represents a small part of the population. So even in the face of all that, there's still communities and organizations and churches that are organizing to do something different, to not support any of the armed groups, to aid people who are displaced by the violence, to speak out against what happened. And to try and create something different.
I've heard the figure, and I don't know how accurate it is, that about 80% of the human rights violations that include rape, torture, murder, disappearances are committed by the Colombian government or the paramilitaries that have close ties to the Colombian government. Is that figure fairly accurate? And if you could also comment on the U.S. relationship to the Colombian government in light of that.
Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty close. It changes a bit, but that's pretty close. And most of those are committed by the paramilitaries. One of the most controversial things is, what is the relationship between the army and the paramilitaries? Because in order to receive U.S. assistance, a Colombian military unit has to be vetted by the U.S. State Department, and it's one of the things it's vetted for is any kind of demonstrated relationship between that army unit and the paramilitaries. And so in one of the areas that's receiving the largest amount of U.S. assistance, which is the Department of Arauca, which is right near the Venezuelan border, very rich in oil wealth, and that's one of the reasons why it's receiving U.S. assistance, is to protect the oil pipeline that's going out of it. That has become an area of great paramilitary violence, where there's a lot of relationships between the army and the paramilitaries. So even the certification process by the U.S. State Department often overlooks that. The State Department issues a report in which it documents cases of collaboration by the paramilitaries with the army, but doesn't see it as a systemic problem. They talk about instances of that collaboration, and it does vary. It differs according to what part of the country you're in and what army unit you're talking about. But it continues to be a very severe problem, and the paramilitaries themselves have said that a lot of their combatants were once army soldiers who were trained within the army, in many cases trained by the United States, and then left the army. Perhaps they left the army because they were accused of collaborating with the paramilitaries. then they join the paramilitaries, and even if they are organizationally independent of the Army, they have benefited from that U.S. training. I mean, the other thing I would say is that, you know, the way U.S. policy, the U.S. law works, that they will only give direct aid to units that don't have this connection with the paramilitaries, they're still institutionally supporting the Colombian Army, which is then able to move its own resources around in order to benefit the units that they want to support.
And in a, oh, sorry.
And, you know, there was a study by the Colombian president, the advisors to the Colombian president last year, where they themselves said that the biggest obstacle to the paramilitaries demobilizing is the Colombian Army itself, because they see the paramilitaries as carrying out the dirty war that they see as most effective in fighting the guerrillas. And, you know, when I say dirty war, I mean all war is dirty, but the paramilitaries' methods are overtly illegal. You know, they go into communities and they just terrorize. I mean, they are on the State Department's list of international terrorist groups.
So when you talk about the U.S. government giving training in some cases, and you say supporting supposedly only the, you know, platoons or whatever in the military that don't have connections to the paramilitaries, but yet they're still supporting the institutional structure, where does the drug war, quote-unquote, the massive aerial spraying come into that picture? My understanding is that under Plan Colombia, we gave the Colombian government so a certain amount of money to, quote, fight, you know, this war, but also supplied them with helicopters that could be used not just to spray aerial spraying, but to attack, you know, to fight a war. So does that play into it?
Yeah, Plan Colombia was introduced in the last year of President Clinton's administration, and initially it was a $1.3 billion plan of mostly military aid. And the idea was, if you could go after coca leaves at their source, then you could make the price of cocaine in this country high enough and the cost of growing coca in Colombia difficult enough or high enough that you would then affect the use of cocaine in this country. That hasn't happened. The Colombian government and the State Department like to talk about the reduction in acreage in Colombia where coca has been grown, although that has now flattened out, so that between last year and this year, between 2003 and 2004, I mean, it was basically even the amount that was planted in coca, because where it's sprayed in one area, then people who are looking for a way to make a living move further into the jungle, or it's grown in other departments, and or even in other countries. For example, in Bolivia, the amount of acreage has grown. So after 2001, however, after 9/11, the plan, the policy, and the restrictions on U.S. aid to Colombia was shifted so that it was not only a counter-drug war, but also an anti-terrorist war. At least that's the way it was sold. And I because anything that had the name counter-terrorism on it was very easy to sell in the U.S. Congress and to the U.S. people. And so the restrictions were lifted on aid so that it's not only helicopters, for example, that would spray or that would take troops to areas where spraying was happening, but also could be used to defend the oil pipeline against guerrilla attacks, because it had been attacked for hundreds of times over, per year in previous years, and also as a directly in order to take the war against primarily the guerrillas. Now, at the same time, Colombian President Álvaro Uribe introduced a process to demobilize the paramilitaries. And this has been very problematic. It's not that everyone wants the paramilitaries to demobilize and no longer process is playing out is that the paramilitaries are, like I said, allied with the Colombian government and the Colombian army. So the negotiation process has been totally behind closed doors. I mean, the terms of it have been in secret. There's no law within Colombia that's governing that process. So what kind of jail terms or pardons there will be for people who have committed crimes against humanity, who have committed atrocities and massacres, many of them being involved in the drug trade, is still unregulated. And in addition, there are major drug traffickers who are now calling themselves paramilitaries in order to take advantage of this process and be forgiven any kind of jail sentences and not be extradited to the United States as part of the process. In addition, during the last 15 years, 20 years, the paramilitaries have taken over and displaced people from a lot of land within Colombia. And there's no mention right now of returning that land to the people who were displaced from that land, that the paramilitaries would give it back. So that's introduced a whole other complicating element into the conflict, because the paramilitaries are still active, although there's a declared ceasefire. There's been about 2,000 people killed by the paramilitaries in the last 2 years. The U.S. is not at least visibly funding the demobilization process. They're kind of having a very cautious response to it. They're not that critical of it, but they're not that supportive of it either. But until that link between the paramilitaries and the army is broken, it's the U.S. aid that's going to the military is at least indirectly benefiting the paramilitary.
How much military aid do we give to the, how much in dollars and also in terms of weaponry are we giving the Colombian government every year?
Well, I couldn't tell you in weaponry. It's about $579 million in military assistance. That's about 80% of all of the aid to Colombia is police or military assistance out of about $700 million. That represents the third largest recipient of U.S. military aid in the world after Israel and Egypt. So Colombia, even though it doesn't get much attention in this country, it's very high on the institutional relationship for the U.S. And in fact, I would say it's the closest ally that the U.S. has right now in all of Latin America, because so much of Latin America, people are throwing out these conservative governments that have been implementing economic policies that cut services and that prioritize paying the international banks over serving the people of their countries. And Colombia is one of the few that still supports that sort of neoliberal economic policy, as well as close to the United States that's left in the region.
Do you think that's the motivating factor then in the U.S. Aid and behavior towards Colombia?
Well, I think they reinforce each other. You have a friend and they support you, and then you feel better about supporting them, and they feel better about supporting you. And, they see, I think Uribe and Bush, they see the world in very similar terms. They see the world as you're either with us or against us. And if you're not with us, then you're with the terrorists. And that's basically the way they see it.
And you're saying they want to advance a certain neoliberal agenda. And Colombia is one of the few countries in South America that's willing to go down that road. Is that part of what you're saying?
Well, they're one of the most eager ones. The Central American countries are small enough that if there's resistance within their countries, they can be bullied much more easily. But I'm thinking about Brazil, Venezuela, Argentina, Bolivia, even whole idea that you have to, everything has to be exported. You know, you have to sell off everything. You can't protect any national industries. You can't develop any national industries through tariffs. You know, it's all being sold to the international corporations that mostly are based in the U.S. and Europe. So there's some, you know, there's resistance, but Uribe is not part of the group that's resisting.
You're listening to 101.1 FM Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm speaking with John Lindsay Poland from the Fellowship of Reconciliation. We're talking about the human rights situation in Colombia, as well as the U.S. government foreign policy towards Colombia. You mentioned the corporations and the multinational corporations, and also that you just mentioned that a lot of these companies that have an interest in the situation in Colombia are based in the U.S., and I'm wondering what role they play. For example, I've heard that Coca-Cola doesn't have a very good record in South America and in Colombia in particular. Can you talk about the role of multinational corporations and U.S.-based corporations in the human rights situation and in the politics?
Well, Coca-Cola is being boycotted in a lot of places now and a lot of campuses because of their record with labor unions in Colombia, where the Coca-Cola affiliate has a record of supporting paramilitary groups and who are murdering some of the labor union leaders and activists in the Coca-Cola bottling plants. The much more prominent case is of Occidental Oil, which has a half of a share in the oil pipeline that goes from Arauca province, which I mentioned earlier, near the Venezuelan border, up to the Caribbean coast. And Occidental Oil does have a number of different places where they're drilling in Colombia and producing. Their vice president, Lawrence Mariage, testified on behalf of Plan Colombia in Congress when it was first came out, and has been very vocal in support of military assistance. British Petroleum also has a very tight relationship with some of the armed groups in Colombia on different sides. I mean, some of the corporations are paying off armed groups in order not to attack them. You know, they're basically being extorted by some of the Colombian armed groups. But that relationship can also develop into a more comfortable one where the armed groups are doing their business for them. They're protecting their plants or, in the cases of paramilitaries, killing off some of the unarmed organizers who are trying to organize labor unions or around land issues. So that's definitely present. In the community where we have a human rights observation team in the Urabá region in the northwest, there's lots of resources that can't be developed that many people think that the international corporations would like to be present, but they can't really be present as long as the conflict, the armed conflict, goes on as it does. So they have an interest in one side winning and taking, you know, the side that supports them winning. This would not be the guerrillas, so that they can actually develop the resources in those areas. So for example, there's coal in that area, and that's true in other places too, where there's a real potential for hydro energy that could be dammed and exported. So I think that's also at work, that the potential for profits can motivate the corporations in order to try and settle things.
In order to try and make some type of peace settlement?
Well, to side with one side.
Okay, and you're saying that they're siding with the government and the paramilitaries because they don't want the rebels to be the ones in control. Are you saying that?
Yeah, I mean, they don't necessarily want to see people killed. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that in order for them to make money, the armed conflict is for some of these corporations is not working. I mean, there's other corporations, for example, the ones that are supplying the helicopters, where the armed conflict is great for their business, you know, or for the narco traffickers, the armed conflict is really good for their business. And so there's other kinds of corporations where it's really not. But they don't necessarily have enough traction in the conflict to, you know, to stop it.
So what companies are, and can you name some of the companies that would have an interest in siding with the government and the paramilitaries in order to, so that they could defeat the rebels and then their business would be benefit from that?
Well, you know, like I said, Occidental Oil and BP, British Petroleum. You know, I think the helicopter, the ones who produce the helicopters, the Black Hawk, which is Bell, I think it's Bell Helicopter down in Texas. And then there's the one in Connecticut. I think it's the General Dynamics company. You know, they certainly have an interest in selling helicopters to the army. They don't necessarily have an interest in the paramilitaries. They don't buy too many helicopters. But, you know, I think for them it's more like it's good if the conflict continues. You know, one of our key demands is that the government negotiate, you know, an attempt to negotiate an end to the war. And really sit down at the table with the different armed groups and civilians who are affected, civil society, women, labor unions, peasants, indigenous people, Afro-Colombians, youth, and try and create a society that is inclusive rather than exclusive.
So is that the root of the conflict, is that the society is exclusive and not inclusive? What exactly is it that the government's position is, the rebels, what's the basic reason for this? I mean, I know there's probably many contributing factors to this conflict, of course, but what is it that the rebels want, and what is it that the government wants? Is it that the rebels are against the neoliberal agenda of the Colombian government and the fact that they're going with the U.S. government's, you know?
Well, again, I want to emphasize the rebels don't represent civil society. They are not a... So I think what they want is, one thing is the commanders, and another thing is the foot soldiers. The foot soldiers, what they want is to be able to survive. So to be able to have a job, to not be killed, to not have their family killed. And the civil society, you know, again, I think it is about inclusion and about sharing the wealth of this very wealthy country in ways that are more equitable, and having a democratic process. I think another big issue is ending the impunity, because there's so many people killed and so few people who are, you know, no one is ever held to account for the vast majority of these crimes. So if you, wherever you are in the society, whether you're in an armed group or whether you're in an unarmed organized group, or whether you're just an ordinary person who's not in an organization, you want the rule of law to work. You know, you want, if somebody commits a crime, you want them to be accountable. And that has been a real sticking point. The guerrillas have attempted to incorporate themselves into civil society before, and they formed a political party called the Patriotic Union in the 1980s, and that political party was essentially wiped out. So they need some guarantees that that's not going to happen again. The paramilitary foot soldiers also need some guarantees that the guerrillas are not going to wipe them out. And civilians need guarantees that if something happens to them, that they're going to have a voice in the process. Even if people are forgiven for their crimes, that the truth comes out and that they have a voice in what happens, and that it's not just dictated from above in some secret process.
What's preventing this kind of resolution from happening that you're describing?
I think it's about political will. You know, I mean, to be honest, if there were more attention to it in this country, this country could have a huge influence.
In what way?
Well, by, you know, it's 579 million is a huge carrot. And if the United States were very serious about, for example, just being consistent about how terrorism is defined. The terrorism is not just defined about in terms of blowing up oil pipelines, but it's defined in terms of civilians who were harmed by a particular group's actions, and that our response to it be in accordance with that. So first of all, to aid the people, to have a compassionate response would help enormously. There are 3 million displaced people in Colombia. If that $600-700 million in assistance were totally reoriented to aiding those people, it would make an enormous difference. It would give people so many more options. I mean, so many people joined armed groups because they can't make a living, and the armed groups pay them. This country could also make a difference through our own consumption patterns. You know, I mean, there's this, you know, concept that countries that have very wealthy, lots of natural resources, like Colombia, like oil, or like coca, that it becomes a curse for them. If we were not so bent on consuming those things, then it would not be feeding the war so much, and people would be able to turn to the things that feed themselves rather than that feed a wasteful culture. So I think this country could make, I mean, those are, you know, long-term fundamental things, but there's also short-term things. For example, this community that I described, San Jose de Partado, in February there was a massacre that witnesses say was carried out by members of the armed forces, perhaps by the army together with the paramilitaries. And this happened right before the State Department, the U.S. State Department, was set to certify a portion of the U.S. military aid to Colombia. And because of the allegations of the Army's involvement, the State Department has delayed certifying that $35 to $40 million in aid, which is having a real impact on the investigation into that crime. And it's a crime that has had a very high profile within Colombia. You know, there were 8 people killed, 4 of them were children. The adults were dismembered. One of the people killed was a founder of this very prominent peace community. So it's, you know, because of the brutality of it against unarmed campesinos, it's become a very prominent case. And here the State Department is actually, for the time being, going by the law and withholding the aid until there's a proper investigation. So one other thing people can do in the very short term is write to the State Department. People can go to our website, and there's a letter that people can download and send to the State Department themselves. And it, you know, we're hearing from the State Department that it's having an impact. Even on Condoleezza Rice's State Department, it's having a real impact.
I just have a couple more questions for you, John. The drug war itself, some would argue the spraying, the aerial spraying of the coca plants, which, by the way, is the chemical used, my understanding is it's Roundup, which is produced by Monsanto, that in and of itself is a human rights abuse because there are children who've been made ill from it, people in general, but particularly children who've been affected as well. There's been a lot of crops that were destroyed that were not coca, had nothing to do with the drug trade. Can you speak to that?
A little bit. It's not happening in the part of the country where our team is. It's mostly happening in the southern part of the country, which is, by the way, where the FARC guerrillas are the strongest. There's also paramilitary and army presence there too. But Glyphosate, which is the key ingredient in Roundup, like you say, does have a negative impact on both human health and on other crops besides coca leaf. You know, one of the problems with this program is that the communities that where this is grown, they were approached by the government when this started and said, they were told, you know, you can voluntarily switch your crops and we will assist you to switch your crops. And then if you don't, then, you know, we'll spray the coca. And in many, many documented instances, those families and communities did not receive any assistance. So they kept growing coca because they didn't get any assistance to grow something else. I mean, these are areas where it's very difficult to get things to market. The narco traffickers have a whole infrastructure. You know, they'll give you what you need to plant. They'll give you the fertilizer. They'll fly the crop in and out. They'll fly in and pay you. And if you're going to grow a legal crop, that assistance is just not there. The state doesn't have that kind of presence in those areas. The only kind of presence they have is army. So they weren't given the assistance, and they were sprayed anyway. Glyphosate was designed. I mean, Monsanto itself says that it's okay to spray it, but not from the air. I mean, it's not designed to be applied broadly like that from an aircraft because you can't be accurate enough. So yes, the spray settles on other crops. It settles on children and adults who are in the area, and there have been a number of health problems. I might add that that's also true over the border in Ecuador, where some of the same spraying has happened, sometimes from Colombia and sometimes from within Ecuador.
I didn't mention, also heard that it's killed animals too, like it might kill someone's entire crop, but also kill all their chickens and other animals or make them ill. So if we could just conclude with, again, what you suggest that U.S. citizens do in, I guess, to suggest to our government and to pressure our government, what kinds of things should U.S. citizens be pressuring our government to do, and what should we be doing personally to improve the human rights situation in Colombia?
Well, one thing people can do is to keep informed and get involved in some way in their community, whether it's getting resources out to their community or hosting a speaker. There's a number of people who have served in Colombia as human rights volunteers, amazing, amazing young people who are back in the United States and you know, can tell the story of their work and of the communities where they've been working. We have a photo exhibit that people can of these communities, which I might add are incredibly beautiful. Colombia is a very beautiful country, and so there's a photo exhibit that we have that people can host in your communities. You can go to our website and get more information. The website is forusa.org, and go to the Colombia link in Latin America on the left-hand side, and there's lots more information there. The other thing I would say is that around Santa Cruz and other areas as well, but Representative Sam Farr has been very active on Colombia, and we would really like him to go and so to Colombia and visit this peace community. There's a congressional recess at the end of May, and we hope that either he or his staff will go. So I encourage people to call either him or your own congressional representative and let them know what you think and encourage them to go. And we can that they can then see for themselves what kinds of activities, what kinds of initiatives Colombians are doing to create some kind of way that's not all about guns and helicopters and destruction.
So you would like him to visit the communities where they're not allowing the armed groups in, and they're trying to find another way to have. They're trying to create a peaceful resolution within their own community by not allowing the armed groups in? Those are the areas you'd like him to visit? Because he has been to Colombia. In fact, he flew down there with Clinton to deliver the Plan Colombia package, and he voted for it. His position on Colombia has not been...
He has changed a bit since that first happened. And I think that he's been educated by some of the community and citizen groups and has shifted. Because I know when Plan Colombia first came out, Sam Farr was one of the ones who helped get it through by agreeing to basically a toothless human rights condition within the package. And I think since then he's sort of seen a bit more about how toothless it is, and has since then voted against the military packages to Colombia.
But he hasn't yet visited some of these areas that you describe where there are people who are not allowing the armed groups in, and you'd like him to do that?
Yeah, he or his staff.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people can call the Congressional Switchboard, which is 202-225-3121, I believe it is, try and connect to him and just let him know that this is an important issue and that you'd like him to visit.
What is that number again?
202-225-3121. That's the Congressional Switchboard. They can connect you to any representative or senator.
Okay. Is there anything else you suggest in light of the U.S. government giving almost $600 million a year in military aid to Colombia? Should we be calling on them to halt the aid until they stop the attacks on civilians?
Yeah, I mean, there's the political possibilities in a Republican-controlled White House and Congress are not broad. So, you know, I think it's great that people demand to end all of the military aid. I mean, we're a peace organization. That's, you know, we would see that it would be so much more constructive to convert all of the aid into non-military aid. But you also have to look at what's going to be politically viable at this time and, you know, be strategic about what's going to go through. So, yeah, support an end to all the military aid. But also encourage people to take the small steps that are going to be necessary for that kind of long-term change.
So you're saying educate yourself, contact your congressperson. You mentioned earlier calling the State Department. Can you again describe, you know, what...
Well, I would encourage people to go to our website. Again, it's www.forusa.org. And go to the Latin America link on the left, and... people can download a letter to the State Department, which basically says, that the State Department should not certify the human rights conditions for military aid to Colombia until there's an effective investigation into this massacre that occurred in San Jose de Portalo, as well as many other cases. And that's, you know, I think that is, there's some momentum growing for cutting off that certification that I think it can be very effective.
Well, thanks so much for joining me today. I've been speaking with John Lindsay Poland of the Fellowship of Reconciliation about Colombia. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Have a good evening.
Take care.
Bye. And again, that was John Lindsay Poland. He is with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and he coordinates the Latin America program for them. The Fellowship of Reconciliation is a national interfaith peace and justice organization, and their website is www.forusa.org. That's spelled forusa.org. And if you want to know about their Latin America program, just click on Latin America, and you can get all the information he was talking about, the letter to the State Department, and other information about what you can do as a U.S. citizen to contribute something positive to the situation, because our government is contributing a lot of military aid to a government and military that is abusing human rights. And in many cases responsible for attacks on civilians. Thank you for listening. This is Peace Talks. Comes to you every Sunday afternoon from 3 to 6. And again, 101.1 FM or freakradio.org.